Hi, I'm Danny Mack, your host, and welcome back to Prospero's Pit. This next episode is a really special episode in a lot of ways. One, it's our 25th episode, which I can't really put into words what that means, but I'm going to try. It feels like just yesterday that I started this, and I started doing this, and I've never thought of myself as a podcaster, but here I find myself. I just want to say thank you. I am incredibly grateful for being your guide, being your host through this wonderful scene that is blooming before our eyes here in Kansas City. It's been an adventure. It's been a wild ride that has, you know, introduced me to so many beautiful people, and I'm so grateful for every single one of the guests that have come onto this show and, you know, shared their life, shared their art, and shared what they've got going on. It's been amazing, and I'm so grateful. And to you, specifically, listener or viewer, I'm so grateful. Thank you, really, from the bottom of my heart for being here. With that being said, you know, we've brought a really special guest in for this 25th episode. And I want to lay the groundwork for him because, you know, he's doing a lot for this city. But first and foremost, he's an entrepreneur and he's a businessman. But where he has his business is very important to this story and to this episode. His business, Ruby Jean's Juicery, is on 3000 Troost Avenue. And if you're not familiar, Troost Avenue is a street here in Kansas City that basically everyone warns you against. Everyone and their mothers are usually going to tell you, don't go to Troost Avenue. Don't go to Troost. That's the hood. And, you know, it genuinely, there's a striking difference, and it's very intentional, from the east side of Troost to the west side of Troost, because Troost Avenue is one of the biggest red lines here in Kansas City, but also in the country itself. What redlining is basically the denial of any sort of loans to specific neighborhoods. So if you live on the east side of Troost, it's much harder for you to get a business loan, a home loan, any sort of loan to, you know, from the bank to help you, you know, improve your life than it would be if you lived on the west side of Troost. And that's really intentional. That was created by a man named J.C. Nichols, who basically orchestrated and designed how we understand suburbia as we know it. There's a reason that suburbs are mostly white and they're, you know, a good deal away from the urban center of a city, right? And that is because J.C. Nichols was a very proud white supremacist, and he genuinely thought it was the best for society if white people were separated from everybody else and kept in, you know, with the best quality of life while everyone else sort of suffered. And he organized, he was one of the biggest forces that, because there were others, right? But that he was one of the biggest forces that organized the white flight from Troost Avenue, because Troost Avenue was not always the hood. In fact, it actually had earned the nickname Millionaire's Row before the Civil War, because so many wealthy Kansas City residents lived upon it. After the Civil War, plots were sold, and it started to become still residential, but eventually a streetcar was built on it, and it started to become more commercial. And so that drew in, you know, a different crowd, a crowd of more diverse faces, right? Meanwhile, on the other side of the city, and in what we have come to know as the Plaza, which is a really nice shopping district here in Kansas City, J.C. Nichols was helping design that and also the neighborhoods around it. And so he orchestrated with the help of shady real estate agents known as Blockbusters to basically sell these homes on Troost Avenue for pennies on the dollar and sell them to black residents for really cheap but really high interest rates so that they eventually would not be able to pay off the mortgages and they would have to sell the homes right back to these Blockbusters who would just rinse and repeat and meanwhile going to every white resident in the neighborhood and saying, hey, look who's moving next door. You should probably get out of here. Oh, by the way, we know of a brand new residency that has just been built a little west of this street. And that is how Troost Avenue became the red line that it is today. On top of that, Troost is the name of Dr. Benoit Troost, who was the first physician here in Kansas City and also opened the first hotel. But he also owned 6 slaves. Our guest today, on top of owning Ruby Jeans, which is a business in itself, which is basically, as a slogan, bringing health food to the hood. And on top of owning this business, having multiple locations, having his product, his juices being sold all over the city in all kinds of diverse businesses across the city, he has also taken upon himself to take on this mission of changing this name, changing Troost Avenue to Truth Avenue, which to me is, you know, one of the, like, is such a beautiful mission, because not only would you be taking your immediate environment and transforming it into something that reflects today's day and age, but also promises a better future, it is also using a word like truth, which is, everybody has some sort of idea, some sort of concept of what the truth is, right? And so when you look at something like truth versus the name of a slaveholder, all of a sudden, conversations are had. Things are brought to the surface that wouldn't otherwise be brought to the surface. And so this mission of changing the biggest red line in Kansas City, and also the biggest red line in the country, and changing it into a vision that reflects the people of this city is monumental, and it's going on right now. Right now, the fight is happening to change this name. With that being said, and with that groundwork being laid, our guest for our 25th episode on Prospero's Pit is none other than Chris Good, owner of Ruby Jeans Juicery, and civil servant to this city. I'm so honored that he took the time to come onto the show, because he's a very busy man, as you could imagine. But on top of all that, he has just become a new father. So congrats to Chris. You know, on top of that, Ruby Jeans was also just honored with a kiosk in the Kansas City Current Soccer Stadium, which is the first women's soccer stadium in the country, and Ruby Jeans has its handprint in that, and I want to celebrate that and say congratulations, Chris. And I'm just honored that he was on here. I'm honored that you're here watching this, listening to this, and without further ado, I want to go straight into the episode. Let's cue the music. Good morning. Welcome to an early rising edition of Prospero's Pit.
Good morning.
Yeah.
It's nice to do it on the A side of the day. You normally do it on the B side.
Yeah, when the sun's been down for hours.
Absolutely.
And so we just got to witness a nice little sunrise. Probably a whole
different environment in here, you know, when it's dark outside.
Definitely. But I feel like this podcast is a perfect episode to bring that early morning rise and shine energy to it.
Absolutely.
So
thank you for having me, bro.
Thank you for being here.
I apologize. It's taking so long.
No, I get it, man. I mean, you got so much going on, and on top of all, like, you know, work-related stuff, you're also a new father, so yeah. I totally get, like, you got a lot going on, so don't even stress about taking the time,
Thank you, bro.
It took to get you on here. I'm just appreciative that you're here. So,
I'm appreciative to be here.
Yeah, and so with that, I'm going to introduce you. I mean, here I am with Chris Good, owner of Ruby Jean's Juicery. That I'm going to let you tell the story, but in short, you know, has an awesome mission of bringing whole, healthy food to Troost Avenue, to east of Troost. A catchphrasey way, you know, bringing health food to the hood.
Yeah.
So I know you have an awesome story behind that, so I'm going to let you tell that.
All right. Shoot. So you just want me to just go into it?
Yeah, tell me the backstory of Ruby Jean's.
Ruby Jean's, man. I would say Ruby Jean's started on Wabash. My parents were young parents. They started having kids. My oldest sister, they had her when they were 16 years old. And so then I'm the last of that crop. And so then when I come around in the early 20s, and you're talking about two poor kids from the east side of Kansas City, you know, becoming parents way too early in life. And so my dad wasn't around early on in a really substantial way. And I don't say that in a way that's like, hey, man, my dad wasn't around. I say it honestly and with an air of gratitude in my tone, because what it lended was time for him to, you know, figure out how to truly be a man, how to provide for kids, how to just earn a living in this world as a poor kid from the east side. But it gave me the opportunity to get extremely close to my mom and my grandmother, who was Ruby Jean. So that's kind of where the story begins. Because my mom was out working, you know, two jobs, three jobs, hotel maid, 7-Eleven cashier. She worked at a lighting store on Warnell. She's jumping in and out of work, trying to make sure that she can provide for four mouths, including her own. And so we spent a lot of time with my grandmother. We lived at 42nd in Wabash. Her house still sits at 39th in Wabash. So in that time we would spend with my grandmother, you know, I got to not only fall in love with a very sincere, gentle woman, a woman of very few words, you know, I got to fall in love with her essence, because she didn't talk a lot. She would give you a look and you would kind of know, like, okay, I'm going to do this based on that look, or I'm going to do that based on this look. But my grandmother, you know, the way that she communicated her love most often was through the dinner table, right? And it wasn't even just the dinner table, it was the table, period, you know, through the kitchen. And the food that she was preparing was the food that she knew. She came from Vian, Oklahoma, to Muskogee, Oklahoma, to Kansas City. And the way they cooked and they ate in Oklahoma, you know, it's country. You know, we're talking fried this, fried that, heavy portions, you know, heavy cream, heavy sugar, heavy salt. And she brought that to Kansas City with her, and that's how she fed us. That's how she fed herself. That's all she knew. Unfortunately, while, you know, soul food was very good, and, you know, we would say my grandma could burn, you know, that ability to cook and improvise, you know, in a culinary way through soul food, it's not a healthy fare. You know, it's not a fair food that's meant to be consumed day in and day out, breakfast, lunch, dinner, in these massive portions. And so when I was 14 years old, this grandmother that, you know, I had fallen in love with, her person and her essence, she got sick. And, you know, she didn't get sick, and it was like a very, you know, subtle or slow, you know, time frame. It was like she was sick and it went fast. It was like grandma's sick and now she's on life support. And so what we found out is that she should have gotten, you know, care a lot sooner, a lot more frequently. But Black people coming from anywhere near the South, as it relates to the healthcare system, there was a huge air of distrust, right? And so my grandmother, you know, she didn't trust the medical system, and so she didn't really subscribe to it.
Mm.
But that forced her into a very, very bad situation. And so when she was 61, my grandmother ended up, you know, laying on her deathbed. And the thing that I think one of the most important moments that really kind of shifted, you know, what we became as a family and what this whole story started is my great grandmother still lived in Muskogee, Oklahoma. My great grandmother came to Kansas City. My grandma, Ruby Jean, she's on her deathbed. You know, they've already said, hey, this is it. My mom, my aunts, my uncle made the decision to let her go. And so mom, who we call my great-grandmother, we called her mom. Mm-hmm. She comes to Kansas City by Greyhound bus. Neither one of them ever learned to drive a car their entire lives. And so she comes just to say goodbye to Ruby Jean. She comes in, spends that last hour with her. She comes back out to the waiting room in St. Luke's, looks around at the family, you know, and kind of is like, this is it. Mom takes this big gasp for air, collapses, and has a massive heart attack. And so my great-grandmother preceded my grandmother Ruby Jean in death unexpectedly, 2 days before Ruby Jean would be taken off of life support. And so in a 48-hour window, two of the most important people that our family had ever, they created our family, you know, they were gone. And so it left this gaping hole, you know, and even, this is in 1999. And so here we are pushing up on, man, 25 years this summer.
Wow.
25 years this summer. And that feeling is, it's as fresh today as it was then. You know, I can see the agony in my mom and, you know, my family and myself, and so it lent itself to, you know, a trajectory where I always wanted to honor who they were as women, who they were as people, because they had this uncanny ability to create an escape for us from this life of poverty, this life of lack. We didn't look at life as if, man, we don't really have a lot. We looked at life as if we got the most, because they wrapped our human experience in like this unparalleled amount of love,
mm-hmm.
like unparalleled. And so I put this mental note in my mind and said, I'm gonna tell people about my grandmothers one day. I played football, so I thought that I would mm-hmm. get a shot at playing for our beloved Chiefs,
mm-hmm.
you know, one day, and I would do something crazy, like I'm going to build a statue for him or something, because I'm definitely going to be rich, you know, mm-hmm. in my 14-year-old.
Yeah.
And so I matriculated through life, and everything I started to do, you know, I honored them with it. You know, I would hit a quarterback as hard as I could, and I would like kiss my fingers and point to the sky like, that's mm-hmm. for you, grandma. And uh-huh. I'm going to go hit him harder next time.
Yeah.
And so it was this driving force, this invisible driving force in my life that no matter what I accomplished, I wanted to honor them with it. Their picture set in my college football locker. You know, my first tattoo, was dedicated to my grandma. A lot of my tattoos are dedicated mm-hmm. to them. But that's the basis of it, where it went from this longing and love for my grandmothers. I ended up a catastrophe adjuster. Fast forward many, many years, graduated college, started my corporate career, and then I landed as a catastrophe adjuster. I started mm-hmm. traveling the country, adjusting large-scale claims, everything from a hailstorm in Colorado to a wildfire in California, earthquake in California, to the Sandy and Irene hurricanes on the East Coast. And so I traveled the country saying, oh, okay, you had hailstorm on your roof. Here you go, Mr. Danny. Here's a check, you know. And then I drive the Liberty Mutual van to the next place, you know, my hat. So I lived that life. And it was such a blessing because financially it was like this pinnacle. I was making north of six figures a year, coming from the east side, you know, graduating from Ruskin High School. Making six figures is substantial, you know. But I ended up at this point where, you know, there was this this emptiness, and I'm traveling for work, and I'm thinking like, man, I did it, you know, I can travel, I'm getting paid good, you know, I'm able to buy my own real estate, like, wow. But this fateful day came where I had been in three different cities, and I landed in Schaumburg, Illinois. And it was the last leg of this trip. Sometimes a storm would dry up, you know, the concentration of claims. And I'm not going to go too much into that, but the concentration of claims would, it wouldn't end up materializing as they saw it. And, okay, go to this next city. Okay, go to this city. And so I had been in three different cities. I end up in Schaumburg in the middle of the night. And traveling as an adjuster, you know, you got your ladder, you got a laptop bag, you got your maybe some food stuff you want to have on the road. Your clothes is pretty cumbersome. And I wake up restless in the middle of the night in a residence inn. And, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm like, where am I at? Like, literally, I couldn't remember where I was at physically. Like, and it, you're in Chicago. And that was a breaking point for me because it's like, man, it's not sustainable. I can't, you know, I just want to be in my own bed. I want to be home. You know, I want a family one day. I can't travel like this forever. So I started to think in that room, like, what do I want to do? What is it? Like, I got here and I thought this is where I'm trying to get a good job, you know? Like, man, this was emptiness. Like, this isn't where my story is. And I started to talk to God, and I started to really ponder, like, well, what is it? Like, what moves you? Football didn't work out. You got a great job. You can help your family. So I felt a little bit guilty, you know, like dang, man, how could you be so ungrateful? Like, you're doing better financially than the majority of people around you. Like, what else could you want? And then my second mind was like, well, what have I fallen in love with? And so then jump over here to this experience I had with two friends in Los Angeles. You're a Cali kid. And so I'm a Kansas City kid. And so I'm taking this trip. This is like a jump, kind of jumping back in time. I take this trip because sometimes when I was traveling, you know, you get all these points built up. And so if you're off a weekend or two weekends, it's like, well, I got these points. I'm going to shoot out to L.A. And so I did that this particular trip. And there's two friends of mine, one from St. Louis, one from Kansas City, that live in L.A. now. Right. And so I go there. I'm just going to hang out. When I get there, they're like, all the pleasantries. How was the flight? How, you know, good to see you. It's been a minute. All that stuff. Pick me up from the airport. And then they're like, oh, stop. We forgot to tell you something. What'd y'all forget to tell me? You know, I'm back there hyped, like, oh, we going to the beach. I got my new shades on. I'm excited to be in LA. And they're like, we're not going to eat today, actually, or tomorrow. What? Y'all not going to eat? Y'all not eating? Y'all not eating what? Like, what are you talking about? Like, what kind of weird stuff is this? And I'm like, they go to explain to me that we're doing this 7-day juice cleanse. And Danny, at this point, the idea of juice cleansing is completely foreign to me. And so I'm thinking, like, man, these dudes, they moved to LA and like joined a cult. Like, they for sure joined a cult. Like, they can't eat. What are they talking about? And so the next day they go to explain to me why they're doing this juice cleanse. And so they sit me down in front of this documentary. And the documentary is called Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead. And there's two parts of it, but this is part one. And at the beginning of it, I'm annoyed. You know, I'm like, yeah. I'm in decent shape. I play football. I work out a lot. Like, I'm cool. Like, y'all can have that. And then I start listening. And this guy in this documentary is a well-to-do guy. And he's struggling with his health in many different ways. He's got boils on his skin, blood pressure issues, weight control problems, on and on and on. And he's taking all this medicine. And he does his research, and he's like, man, I got the best doctors. I got the most access to healthcare that you can have. And it's not working. It's not fixing me. And he lands on juice cleansing. And so this guy in this documentary, he does this. It's pretty tough. I would say there's a very slim percentage of people in the human population that can actually do this, but it's possible. He drank juice for 60 days, 2 months straight. He set out on a juice cleanse for 2 months. No solids, no caffeine, just fresh juice, fruits and vegetables turned into liquid. And so this documentary shows him going through this process, you know, the challenges of it on the front side, low energy, moodiness, you know, caffeine withdrawal headaches, on and on and on. But then you watch this documentary and it gets to an ending point. And so now I'm in tune with it. And I'm sitting up on the couch, tiny little North Hollywood apartment, and I'm like dumbfounded, because the point where it triggered for me is because this guy drank only juice for 60 days. Mm. Grandma lived 61 years, but she never had this moment of, you know, self-reconciliation surrounding her own health. She literally ate soul food and lived the lifestyle she was living, a sedentary lifestyle, until it killed her. Whereas this guy was able to say, I'm going to grab the reins because it's slipping away from me. And I'm gonna bring the ship back. My grandma never had that. And I'm like, whoa, he was able to change the trajectory and really save his own life in 60 days. Now, it's difficult, but he did it. By the end of this documentary, I'm looking at a completely different human. And I'm like, oh, my God. Oh, I get it now. So I come home to Kansas City and I do a 10-day juice cleanse. I'm one of those people that sometimes I'm going to go way too hard. Like, I don't know, like, how to temper things. Like, no, it's either I'm sprinting through the wall or I'm not going to do anything. Mm-hmm. So I go to sprint through this wall, and I get to about day three, and I'm like, I don't know. This is a little bit extreme. Mm-hmm. And I felt terrible. I'm like, I should not feel like this. Nobody should need to be this healthy, like, and go through this kind of torment. I push through it. I get through day 10. And Danny, I had this awareness, this clarity, this bounce, this energy that I had never experienced. I never experienced it. And I was like, oh, there's something to this. It like opened up a new layer of vision for me. Mm-hmm. And so I'm traveling for work. Still at the time. So I start going to juice bars coast to coast. If I'm in San Diego, I'm going to go to like the best juice bars. If I'm back in Kansas City, I'm going to start checking out the juice bars. And what I realized as I'm going to these places is that there was this disconnect, you know, between, and I didn't know it on the surface. Let me wait on that.
yeah, keep going.
I didn't know it on the surface, you know, but subconsciously, I was not their customer. Mm. And so, jump back to Chicago. So, I'm in the middle of the night. And at this point, I've been getting menus, taking pictures of juice bars. It just as a consumer, I'm on Yelp, like, looking up the top juice bars. I'm going to Oklahoma. Is there a juice bar there? I'm going to D.C. Is there a juice bar? And so, I'm going to the Philadelphia Public Market, which is crazy, by the way. Have you ever been?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. So they had this, I remember they had this special fresh juice. It was pineapple and carrot at this one particular place. Mm. And I'm drinking this juice and I'm just falling in love with fresh juice. Mm. Chicago, what do you want to do? What do you want to do, Chris? God, what do you want me to do? I love health and how I feel when I'm healthy. I've started to make my family drink these disgusting juice recipes that I'm tinkering with. My friends will go on a trip to Puerto Rico and they'll tell you still to this day, like, I'm in there like a little chemist. I might as well have goggles on and, you know, Bunsen burners and stuff, like trying to figure this thing out. And I had fallen in love with the culture of it. I had, you know, started to encourage my family, like, hey, we maybe need to chill out on the fried chicken. Maybe, you know, getting on their nerves, you know, like, probably been a little too pushy with it because I'm so excited. Like, juice, frick. You know, you get into something. It's like, I want everybody to, you should drink juice.
Yeah.
And man, I sat in that room and in my, you know, in my really like the, the deepest part of that query, you know, with myself, God is like, dude, I'm not gonna like write it on the wall, you know, I'm putting it in front of you. Mm-hmm. And it hit me like a ton of books. That's corny, nice. But sorry. I'm just looking at all these books. Yeah. But it really hit me hard. And it's like, start a juice bar and honor your grandmother. I'm sitting there looking at my tattoos like, what is it? Like, damn, I miss my grandma. I got like a traveling ninja contraption thing. I got all these menus. I've been to a juice bar, you know, every single trip for a long time. Start a juice bar and honor your grandmother. Mm. I shot up like, whoa. I've been doing all this research. I got all these menus. I've been in all these places. I felt this disconnect between this offering and why I feel compelled to do it. And it all kind of came together. And so from that point to now, I made every single mistake you could ever imagine. I jumped out. I quit my job. I started telling people, like, hey, I'm gonna, and ironically, I had moved to LA. Mm-hmm. I had moved to LA for about 1.5 to 2 years. And when this idea really set firmly on me, I'm like, man, I gotta put my base back in Kansas City, because LA, you know, I mean, there's juice bars there. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I want to do because of my grandmother that I want to bring home. Mm-hmm. And so I came home to Kansas City. I put everything I had and didn't have into our very first location. And when I say everything I had and didn't have, I mean it. Mm-hmm. Like, charged up my credit cards, took out the penalty on the 401k, early withdrawal from my job, mm-hmm. quit my job. And I started sprinting through a wall again. And July 25th of 2015, we opened our very first location at 40th and Broadway in a tiny 700 square foot spot. And, you know, God breathed life into it. And Danny, for the last, it'll be 9 years in business come this July. You know, we've opened several locations. We've closed several locations. We've been robbed. We've been through a pandemic. I can go on and on, mm-hmm. but that is the origination journey of Ruby Jeans in a nutshell. You know, and, you know, by the grace of God, man, we've been able to stay. Mm-hmm. You know, we've been afforded the opportunity to keep fighting and keep serving people in, now, as you know, a multitude of ways, you know, because Ruby Jeans is always still the foundation. You know, it's the fuel, it's the reason, you know. So everything else that has been put around the orbit of Ruby Jeans, it all really ties back to, you know, creating healthier people, more aware people, more conscious people, more healthy communities, in an audacious way, mm-hmm. in a way that's not like judgy. It's not like, you're getting kind of chubby. Like my old aunts and stuff, you walk in, you gained a little weight, they're going to tell you. Like, yeah. Hey, you're looking a little round now. You know? But that's right. Not our approach. Right. You know? And so I'll stop there.
No, that was, I mean, it's such an incredible story. And to know that last week you guys had a stall at the new Kansas City Current Stadium, absolutely. Which is the first stadium for women's sports. And absolutely. To see Ruby Jeans there was like, knowing that story, because I've heard that story a few times and it always gives me chills every single time. But like seeing that just on social media, I mean, what an incredible journey. And like to see, obviously there's still so much ahead, but I really want to celebrate that fact that you guys were there at a moment in history as for the city, but also for such a larger picture. To see Ruby Jeans like having their handprint on it is so incredible. So congratulations.
Bro. Thank you, bro. Yeah, that's, yeah. It's like there's a level of, it's just kind of surreal, mm-hmm. a little bit. You know, because I still feel very connected to that hotel room in Schaumburg, Illinois, mm-hmm. you know, where I'm not going to get emotional today. I ain't gonna do that.
Feel free, man. This is a safe space.
You know, like you, like I've learned to be grateful when God gives me an idea, when he gives me a thought. Like, I've learned to be extremely grateful in that moment, you know, because those little just like shreds of thought, of imagination, of dreams, or however you want to look at them, they can end up where you're getting to be a part of having your grandmother's face and likeness perpetuated in a historic moment for women, celebrating a woman, the woman's love that was poured into me as a little kid on the east side. And so it's such a full circle opportunity that I just find this deep level of gratitude in, because, you know, it's hard running a business.
Yeah.
And so to take it from thought to conception to, you know, something that has the ability to grow and be a part of such a moment as that, it's just like, it just leaves me like just a lot of times just really sobbing in gratitude.
Yeah. And you know, the saying goes, God works in mysterious ways. To think back, like all the way back to that moment where you lost your great-grandmother and your grandmother in the span of 72 hours, like the whole, you mentioned it, and like the, you know, pit that opens up to go from that moment all the way to, you know, where you are now, where like this seed of grief and, you know, darkness all of a sudden blooms into what we're like witnessing right now, and what Ruby Jeans has become and is on its way to becoming. You know, yeah, it's such a phenomenal story. And, you know, you talk about that hotel room in Illinois. When you talk and you talk about these stories, I can't help but see how much reflection and self-awareness that you have about it. I'm curious, like, when, you know, that moment happened where you found yourself truly understanding your story from a day one to, you know,
man,
that period of time.
Great question, bro. Nobody's ever asked me that. I honestly don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just this, it's kind of this continual experience that, it's like this, it's just one thing, you know, that just culminates in my mind as like my human experience, because, you know, I start to think about how active I am and how I'm pulled in so many different directions. And then my adult mind that's almost 40 thinks that, well, man, God's been setting the stage for me to have the capacity and gumption to be this stretched and strained since I was in the sixth grade, you know? So I think that starting business and taking risk and facing trials and tribulations and, you know, expanding your personal capacity and love and, you know, because at the end of the day, I'm a steward of people. You know, that's really what being an entrepreneur and a small business owner is about. It's about loving on people and not just the people that come in and purchase, you know, a smoothie, which, yeah, I mean, you can't really put more of a emphasis on the people that support your business. But the people that I think a lot of times get forgotten in that, it's like, you know, we always hear the customer is always right. The customer is first, you know, like the customer. And while I agree with that to an extent, man, it's the people that labor day in and day out that even create what the customer can consume. Because now I don't have the ability to make every juice. I was in first 8 months to a year of business, I'm making drinks, I'm unclogging the toilet, I'm cleaning up poop outside, I'm the trash, I'm the this, I'm the that, we're out of bananas, pew, I'm out of here, I'm gonna. And so now to have an ability, an opportunity to have a group of people around me that have a shared belief in this dream that God planted in my spirit years ago in a hotel room, bro, it forces you into reflection. If you're forced into it, because you gotta be able to source from something, right? Hear me out on this. and I'm sorry if I get long-winded. Chop it down however you need to. But
talk.
In order to stand at point A and just create movement, right? Movement to something. Even if it you don't get all the way to G or whatever letter in the alphabet, right? Even if you only go to C, in order to move, you got to source from something. There has to be energy to create movement, right? And so then where does that energy come from? What is the source of that movement? Like, the what is that source that actually gave you the ability to say, you know what? I'm going to tell stories. I'm going to create a podcast. I'm going to spend my personal time to create platform for people. You are in motion, right? Where is the source of that? And so it forces reflection, because my source, it goes way back decades ago. I'm running up and down the stairs of my grandma's little bitty home on Wabash. You know what I mean? Like, that's a source that you got to pull from, because if you're pulling from this new source of just trying to keep up with today and like the glamours of the day and the facade of today, it's going to be shallow and it's going to be fleeting. And so my source is Christ, as you know, and I'm open about that. And even beyond Christ, it's that nucleus of love, you know, that my grandmother's created, that my mom created, and then even my dad came into the picture later and added to. So yeah, it forces reflection, you know what I mean, for me to continue to move, because there's some days I don't feel like it, dog. Like, I just don't feel like it. I don't have it today. And so when those days hit, you got to be able to, like, go down. I'm like, ah, where is it at? I'm getting to operate a business on land that slaves lived on. Right?
Yeah.
And so in the face of discomfort and difficulty and strain and strife and opportunity, you know, you got to pull from something that's real. If you pulling from a, you know, a faulty source, like, oh, I'm trying to be cute, I'm trying to be popular, you know, it ain't gonna last.
Yeah. So much to unpack there. But I think the main thing that I took away from that is, like, you just described to me so many aspects of leadership. Like, when that idea that was so yours all of a sudden becomes ours, and it becomes like you're looking around at people who believe in your dream just as much as you do and are sacrificing almost as much as you do, sometimes even more, to, like, because they believe in it so much.
Yeah.
And I think, like, that's a perfect bridge into, like, talking about what you got going on in a bigger picture, in a bigger sense, with Truest Avenue, and that, you know, mission to building it into Truth Avenue.
Yeah. You know, so I don't know where to start on that, Danny. But Truest, you know, people will ask me, like, how'd you pick this location? And, you know, the unique thing about my personal journey and this business journey to land at 30th and what is now still called Truest Avenue, is that location picked me a long time ago, because we lived on Wabash, right? My grandmother worked at Superior Linen on Cherry, which is still there on Cherry, a few blocks to the west of our Truest location. But in between those two places, there's a bus stop that we now have a hand in. We can talk about it later. There's a bus stop hub at 31st and Truce. And catacorner to that, there's a place that today is known as Operation Breakthrough. Well, I attended Operation Breakthrough many years ago, over 30 years ago, as a kid for daycare. And it was known as St. Vincent's. And so I got to attend this place as a low-income kid that wrapped low-income kids and families in love, right? And this is 30-plus years ago. Well, we would come over to the bus stop to go to school. My grandmother would come over to the bus stop to walk into work. There's one more place in that nucleus of places. There was this day-old bread store just a little bit to the north and to the west of the daycare. Day-old bread store is now our 30th and Truce location. And so when I walked into that building, I'm a low-income kid going in with my mom, with my grandma, and we're going in to get bread that's going to expire, you know, soon. So it's a little bit cheaper. Some baked treats that are going to expire soon. So it's a little bit cheaper. So that day old bread store, it came into my life decades ago. And then a whole bunch of years removed, I get afforded the opportunity to start a business there as a tenant. And then more years after that, I get this uncanny opportunity to own that building. And so I don't even know what the question was or where we went from it. But, you know, that location of Truth, that location on Truth, you know, like God did this thing. It's like here. All right. Build, grow, you know, change. And then, oh, I'm going to bring you back to it. And so I arrive at it in a place of honesty, of struggle, of almost impossible opportunity, right? This mountain to get back to this building that was a part of my past. And so my heart is really pure to it. And so then at a point, this becomes this and this becomes this. I get appointed to the Parks and Rec Board by our now mayor, Quentin Lucas, right? He appoints me to the Parks and Rec Board because of my heart for service, for people, because of this Paseo Stairs project. He says, hey, what do you think about Parks and Rec? I'm like, I don't know. I'll give it a shot. It's a way to impact people, change environment. I'm in, sign me up. So I get in and I start learning it. Well, fast forward, 2020 happens. And, you know, there's this very, very public, painful, I mean, the world is put on notice through it being made very apparent, the disregard for Black life, right? I don't have to go too far into that moment, but the world is on notice that Black people are being not only marginalized, they're literally being murdered. And it begs the question, well, how many times did that happen where it wasn't caught on tape? And so I'm sitting there as a Parks Board member, and I'm seeing people protest. I live in this little apartment building right next to the church on 46th Street, and these protests are happening, and it starts to like get heavier and heavier, and this anxiety is just rolling around in my spirit, and I'm seeing the people marching and I'm seeing it, and I'm like, man, I don't feel like that's my role. You know, what is my role in this conversation? And so I look at it, the landscape, and I'm like, man, all these people come to protest at this place, and truth be told, the architect of this place, JC Nichols, he didn't want this. He didn't want there to be this inclusive, you know, this outspoken space for people of all shapes, sizes, colors, creeds, sexual orientations, religions. That wasn't the way. He only created it for a small percentage of people, a very affluent white audience exclusively. Don't even come over here. And not don't come over here. We're going to put in restrictive covenants these places that we create. You literally cannot be here. And so I'm like, huh, here we are as this city, and we've got this place where people are gathering to speak up in protest. And the backdrop of it is stained. It's stained with hatred. It's stained with, you know, this evil. And so how about we rebrand this place? How about we start actually digging up these old racist roots and untangling them? And so I set forth a charge. I wrote a memo in June of 2020 and said, you know what? It's time that we do a rebranding. And that's not what I said, but to capture it quickly, it's time that we do a rebranding and rectify some of the ills of the past. And we remove the name of JC Nichols from this very public place that people come to gather and share and speak about what they care about. Went through a long, drawn out, I mean, arduous process, and at the end of it, we removed the name of JC Nichols from the parkway adjacent to the plaza that he created. We removed the name of JC Nichols from the fountain where it had this bronze writing about contributing him as one of the most contributory people in the city of Kansas, in the history of Kansas City, And so that was the start. And so we made this removal, and it was such a proud day, you know, when the sign came down, because it was just a narrative shift to say, hey, we're not going to be like ignorant of the landscape of this city.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to clean it up. And that started a process. And when I did that, people would come to me and say, well, what about truce? What about truce? And I would listen, and I wasn't really connected with the history of it as much.
Mm-hmm.
But then I started to do this work, and I started to read about it, and I started to learn about who this man was, and I became disgusted. Mm-hmm. Because I served that street. You know, I spent time on that street, and we go up and down the street, and it's almost like this unaware, apathetic approach to life, because all this labor picking up trash on this street and hovering over us in this very proud, noble way. Truce.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. This guy was honored with an 11-mile stretch. He must have been awesome. He did so much for us as a people. He advanced us so much. Well, maybe on the surface, he was the first resident physician. He built the first hotel. He's considered to be a forefather of this great American city.
Mm-hmm.
But then right underneath the surface, whoa. Oh, whoa, hold on. Wait a minute. He owned people? Oh, he owned people.
Mm-hmm.
They were his possession. And they look like me. They talk like me. They walk like me. So then, okay. In this modern day time, we talk about slavery as if it's this relic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's this, it happened, slavery. There's this cavalier tone put to the word slavery. I don't feel it that way. I don't feel it that way at all. If you were a slave owner, that means as soon as you say you were willing to own people, that means you stole humanity from people. You literally stole their humanity.
Mm-hmm.
There's somebody that owns this thing, right? The owner of this bookstore, this is his.
Mm-hmm.
He bought this. It's a thing. It's an inanimate object that's a thing. It doesn't move. It's a thing. So then I'm sitting here, and I can talk. I can breathe. I can see. I can feel air. And to say that somebody has the ability to own me is disgusting. That means that he is okay with people hanging from trees. He's okay with people being raped. He's okay with kids being ripped out of their parents' arms. He's okay with lineage being disrupted. He owned people. It's 2024. We're celebrating that.
Mm.
And I don't give a damn if it was a norm of the past. It's a reality. And I'm not okay with it. And at some point, there's somebody that's not afraid to speak up about it. There's somebody that says, I don't care how much hate you have in your heart. I'm going to stand firm on the fact that racism is, was, and will forever be wrong. And if you say slavery in a cavalier manner, don't say it in my presence. Because I'm going to fight for it. And even if I have to die fighting for it, I'm willing to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I set out to say it's time to rebrand Truce Avenue. And we're going to do it in a manner that's bold, that's audacious, and flips it in a 180 and says, this isn't noble and he shouldn't be honored. And I don't care how many of those names are honored across this city, across this country. If it's a painstaking approach, every single one should be removed, because you're not noble. You built a hotel because you stole human life and you stole labor to do it. When I do my accounting and my expenses in my books, you know what the most expensive line item is? Labor. And so if I had the ability to eliminate that entire line item, because I stole people to do it. I literally stole their existence. There's nothing noble about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not to be celebrated. It's to be talked about. Yes, it's a part of our history. It can never be sanitized. It can never be erased. But if we allow that hatred and that vitriol and that evil to maintain, man, we'll never be able to fight the evil of today because we haven't rectified the evil of the past. We talked about movement coming from a source. And so we as a city are moving in a progressive manner, but we still have a source of how this place was created and how it was, who were the architects of it. Well, you start to peel back, those architects were evil. Mm-hmm. And we got to call it out and pull it out and do it where it's like, well, let's talk about it in truth.
Mm. Yeah. And, wow. Everything you just said is represented in those 11 miles of Truce Avenue right now. Like every quarter mile, everything that you just talked about is in the pavement that runs through the city. You bring up J.C. Nichols. J.C. Nichols, on a bigger picture, you know, not only did he orchestrate this in our immediate area, in our city, in Kansas City, but this became the blueprint for the rest of America. Like, you want to know why suburbs are majority white and why they seem to be separated from, you know, the most urban areas? That was all by J.C. Nichols' design.
Absolutely.
And you look at Truce Avenue, there's a reason that it's such a stark line, that the east side of Truce looks so different than the west side of Truce, that there is this moment when you cross that street, there is a change that is like visceral. You can visually, you can feel it in a spiritual sense, but you can actually see the change in community. And there's a reason behind that. It's actually incredibly intentional. You know, we're sitting in a bookstore with 50,000 books. We know the power of words. We know what, like, the, you know, how powerful words are. Choosing the right words to represent us is everything. And, you know, having 11 miles of one word, you know, is intentional. I think one of the, you know, the opposition side, one of the, their biggest weapons is kind of deflecting that and being like, oh, it doesn't really matter. It's just a street sign. Like, it's just for business. It's just for an address purpose. No, that's not true. You know, these words is something that I'm digesting every day, that most of the, you know, a huge portion, a majority of the city is digesting every day. And, you know, the biggest lie to tell anybody is to say, you know, that doesn't do anything to you. That doesn't do anything to your psyche. It doesn't do anything to your mind. Right. And, you know, like, the, you know, I think the biggest lie that we could tell ourselves is that changing the words that we live our everyday life with, changing the words that we dictate how this city moves with. I mean, you know, think about, you know, one of the biggest businesses in this country that like is a big, like runs this country is all about, you know, delivering your packaged goods directly to you, mm-hmm. which is using your address. Mm-hmm. And so in this country, in America, our address is so much of our identity, is so much of who we are. So when you tie a slave owner, someone who owned people, to your identity, you can't tell me that doesn't do something.
It's no way. It's no, yeah. and it goes, it's so perpetual. You know, to anyone that says in this current day and age that symbolism is insignificant, they're lying to themselves. Yeah. I'm looking at your hoodie right now, mm-hmm. and, you know, there's a brand on it.
Yeah.
A very popular brand, right? And that hoodie, if you take that, you just take that. It's just a black hoodie with this one little very distinct, it's tiny. The hoodie is you know, is this, but then that one little logo is like this big. You remove that logo from this black hoodie, you remove your interest from that black hoodie. Mm-hmm. Right? You remove your interest from that black hoodie. There's all this development going on up and down this street called Truce. And they're not, you know, it's Truce is booming, Truce is booming. Well, that's an identity that we're allowing to hold on to. And that identity is drenched in blood. Mm-hmm. And people are afraid of it still, right? Subconsciously, consciously. Oh, don't go to Truce. don't, if you go to truth, stop there. Don't go past it for sure. Still, still. And we're, as a city, we're okay with that. We're okay with that. Don't pay attention. That doesn't matter. We got to focus on real change. We should pay attention to it. And it just, you know, people have tried it for years and years and years to get this thing changed unsuccessfully. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's, you know, this very silent, hidden population of the community that wants it to remain the same. And I think that even that, when you look at it and you know that there are people that want this to stay the same that aren't willing to say that publicly because they know that it's it's not a good thing to say. Man, it's got to go.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, you look back at the history and you talk about drenched in blood because it is. It literally, there people have died because of this. Families have been wiped out because of this. You know, truce, there, and the reason why is because very short-sighted, there was money to be made in this, right? Like, the you know, people were sold this false you know, reality that, you know, houses were sold really, you know, cheaply to people. And then using that influx of, you know, when homes are being sold to for cheap, they're targeting a certain demographic of people who don't have as much money. And in America, that's Black people, people of color. And using that influx of people to then frighten the white population and say, look who's moving in next door. You should probably get out of here. And while you're at it, sell me your house.
For pennies on a dollar.
For pennies on a dollar. It's not even just, you know, Black people are taking the brunt of it. Black people are dying. But it's, you know, white people are also being made a fool. You're also being used, your ignorance and your fear, they're being, you're being fear-mongered too. You're losing, like, you are being conned as well. And that is, like, I think that silent majority wants it to stay silent because the only people who are winning in this situation are them, because they're able to operate in the shadows. They're able to orchestrate these things that lead to violence, that lead to death, that lead to hatred and division. Because they're not even, you can't even identify them. You can't even say a name to those people. But one of the biggest names, you know, in our city is on the street, you know, is separating us. Absolutely. And truced.
Absolutely. We literally shouldn't, that those names, those powers that be didn't want us to do this, right?
Yeah.
You as a white man, me as a Black man.
Yeah.
We created a barrier between this kind of dialogue between humans, man. And there's a, you know, there's a very, what you're talking about is a very crafty approach at economic oppression, right? And it's cyclical because now you have this renaissance on truce. Well, that white flight that you're describing, it drove property values down, 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 down. But the community that knows us to be home, my family that use this area, this is home. We don't get to benefit from that very low cost. We're not in position to benefit from it. And so then those same powers that be come in and say, oh, it's cheap again.
Yeah.
Let's go scoop it up and let's create all this development. And now you've got $600,000 and $700,000 houses and $1 million buildings and all of this stuff. And typically, the displaced community does not get to benefit from it. We stand in a very unique position where we as tenants drove the value up of our real estate and then had to purchase this inflated value that we created. But at the end of the day, we get to sit at the table and say, you know, we're owners. And so we have a voice in this conversation and we have the audacity to even not have a voice in it, but drive the conversation and be bold about the conversation and not allow stagnancy and this disillusionment that tries to be created around symbolism to thwart those efforts. It's a persistent, nasty dogfight. And I'll be lying to you if I said it didn't, you know, worry people around me that, man, are you speaking too boldly? know, are you standing too firmly? Is this too big of a risk? And, you know, God put something in my spirit, man. It just won't allow me to be fearful. And even when I do approach that fear, to still push past it.
Mm-hmm. And with all that to say, like, you know, what rises above it and is able for us to have these kind of conversations is, you know, truth. You know, that's what puts everything into light.
It's powerful, man. Yeah. When we can look at ourselves first in the mirror and say, because I got to look in the mirror at me.
Mm-hmm.
And like, hey, man, why are you doing this? What's your true intention behind this? Or how are you being as a father? How are you showing up as a husband? How are you showing up as a friend? How are you showing up as a leader? And what's the source of it? And so I got to look at myself first and say, I can be truthful with me. We all have to. There's nothing. There's no way anything will ever move anywhere or become anything if we as individuals, you as Danny, me as Chris, don't have that moment of truth with self first. So it's truth is powerful, bro.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was beautifully said, and I think that's a perfect place to wrap this up. Thank you for being on here. Absolutely. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, man. I don't take it for granted, you know, I get a lot of opportunities to speak and to share and to be a voice, right? Mm-hmm. And every single time, you know, it leaves me in gratitude. I walk into this space, you know, asking God to speak through me. And just, you know, be a lamp to my feet continually, but you have to create the platform and mm-hmm. you then have to extend the platform,
mm-hmm.
you know, for an opportunity. So I'm grateful to you, man. It's been a privilege to start to get to know you, and I'm excited to see what we work on, man.
Yeah. Thank you. And likewise. Yeah. Awesome.